responsibility.
Okay, we're continuing with Parshat Vayishlach, and we have this amazing moment where Vayivatel Yaakov Levado. Yaakov remains alone. Why does he remain alone? So earlier in the week we learned the Chizkuni, the interpretation that his children made a mistake, they let him go back alone. We learned the Midrash that's quoted in Rashi, that Yaakov Avinu went back for Pachim Ktanim. The Gemara that says that Tzadikim are careful about every penny because they're careful to be honest. And when you're honest about every penny you earn, then every penny matters. But there are other Midrashim. There's a Gemara that says that the angel appeared to Yaakov Avinu like a Talmid Chacham. Yaakov Avinu was standing there and suddenly he saw a big Talmid Chacham approaching him. And then he pounced on him. And then a fight broke out. There's another Medrash that says he appeared to Yaakov Avinu like a listim. He appeared like a gangster. Yaakov Avinu thought there's an armed robber against me. And there's a third Midrash. Vayaveret asher lo, the Medrash says, Yaakov Avinu transferred everything that was his. His sheep, his camels, and then he went back to check. Now, the Medrash says, as Yaakov approached the Yabok River, there was another shepherd standing there. And the other shepherd said to him, you can go first, go ahead, that's fine. So Yaakov's in a rush, he transfers all of his cattle. And he finishes transferring everything. And then he comes back to take another look to make sure he didn't forget anything. And at that point, the shepherd who was standing there starts fighting with him. I let you go first. Why are you coming back now? Why are you coming? And then he attacks him. And so, whichever interpretation, whichever midrash you're going to take, the Talmid Chacham, the Listim, the shepherd, there's a message for Yaakov Avinu. And the message is a preparatory one. The angel is coming and preparing Yaakov for his meeting with Esav. We have two approaches among Chazal. Was this the bad angel of Esav who came to try and take Yaakov Avinu down? Or was this a good angel who came to detain Yaakov and prepare Yaakov for his meeting with his brother? Until now, Yaakov has had to deal with life in one manner. He's outsmarted Esav. He's outsmarted Lavan. He's dealt with things without facing them head on. And now the angel is coming to prepare Yaakov to take on Esav head on. So whichever interpretation we're going to go with, whether the angel appears to him as a rabbi, the angel appears to him as a gangster, the angel appears to him as a shepherd who says, I let you go first. Why are you coming back now? There's a message. Yaakov's going to have to face a brother who he went first. He got the blessings, and now he's coming back. And he's going to face up to that brother. And before Yaakov faces the brother, he sees that he can be victorious with an angel. And the angel will tell him that's your new identity. You enter this land, you are no longer Yaakov, the one who does things in an okba, in a sly roundabout way. You are Yisrael, the one who faces up to challenges and overcomes them. And even if they are godly beings, you overcome. Yisrael, by definition, is the one who can overcome the forces, including the forces of nature. And that is you now. So when Yaakov is about to meet his brother, he's getting a new identity. An identity that we proudly hold on to till today. The term Yisrael is our ability to overcome the forces of nature. So, the angel wounds Yaakov. According to one opinion, he causes his thigh to split in half. It wasn't just he wounded him deeply, but the whole bone cracked straight down the middle. And then he says, let me go. The morning's coming. And he says, no, you're going to bless me first. And he says, the Medrash says, he said to Yaakov Avinu, I wasn't sent to bless you. I can't bless you. And Yaakov Avinu says, I don't know. You're saying you're an angel. When angels visited my grandfather, Avram, they didn't leave without giving him a blessing that he would have children. Bless me. And the angel says, God didn't send me for that. And Yaakov Avinu says, well, now you're mine. I'm not letting go of you. So you're going to have to bless me. You did yours, now I'm doing mine. And the angel tries a few different arguments, and every time Yaakov Avinu says, I'm not letting go, so you have to decide what you're going to do. So the Medrash says, the angel started thinking to himself. He said, well, God reveals to his pious ones what's going to be. So if I'm taken to task for revealing what's going to be, I'll just say, God, I thought you approved, because you do that too. You also give prophetic visions to your pious ones. And so the angel reveals to him, Beit El Yimtzeinu, as we read in the Haftarah this week, V'sham Yedaber Imanu. When you will come to Beit El, Hashem will speak to us and change your name to Yisrael, and at that point I will be there too, and I will join the blessing of the name change. That you are now a new person. You are now a person who overcomes. And according to one opinion, that's all the angel told him. According to another opinion, Yaakov Avinu said, we're not waiting to Beit El. You're going to admit that that's my identity now before I have to meet with Esav. And that's how the story ends, where he concedes that even now, his name is Israel. He's the one that was victorious. The sun shines, and he's limping, and he looks up, and there's Esav. And Esav's coming with 400 men, and each of those 400 men have 400 men. And Yaakov quickly splits the family in two, and he passes before them, and he bows 7 times. He's bowing. One of the rules in quarrels is the verse in Proverbs. It says in Mishlei, Ma'ane rach, Meshiv Chema. Ma'ane rach, answering gently, Meshiv Chema, rescinds anger. You see someone's angry, they come and yell at you. Try talking gently. Try talking softly. You don't have to give in. But if you talk gently, very often you've lowered the fuse, you've lowered the anger. So Yaakov Avinu is putting himself down before Esav. If we tell someone, you're right, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. If we say it sincerely, how much can they yell at you? So Yaakov bows. And Esav runs at him. And they hug one another. Vayichabekehu. He hugs Yaakov. Let's look back at the pasuk with the angel. What does it say over there? Vayeavek. Here it's Vayechavek, and over there it's Vayeavek. What's Vayeavek? Vayeavek ish imo. Rashi says the word Yeavek comes from the word Chovek, to hug, of Kobizro Otav, that a person wraps him with his arms. So Vayeavek ish imo, they were wrestling and grappling, Yaakov and the angel. And now there's a similar scene happening with Esav. Vayipol al tzavarav, Esav falls on Yaakov's throat. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Now we have a tradition that there are dots in the Sefer Torah. Now in ancient times, you wouldn't cross through a word. Whenever you want to erase something, you'd put a dot over it. If you want to erase a whole word, you'd either put a dot over each letter or put a line over the word. You didn't put a line through the word. That was the way they used to write. So the Medrash says, whenever you have dots over a word, if you have more dots than the word, then the dots overcome. If you have more word than the dots, then the word overcomes. It depends on whether it's coming to tell you put more of a stress on the word or reduce the meaning of the word. But here we have a dot over each letter. So it's equal. So the Medrash says, so which way does it go? Is it coming to strengthen the word or weaken the word? Is it coming to tell you when he kissed him as powerfully as he could, it's strengthening the word he kissed him? Or is it diminishing the word, vayishakehu? It's telling you that he didn't really kiss him. And there are two opinions in the Medrash. Your children will come home and tell you the famous Medrash that he came to bite him in the neck. He wanted to kill him with his own teeth. He made believe he was going to kiss him, but really he opened his mouth and tried to take a big chunk out of Yaakov's neck. And the Medrash says that about this moment, the Pasuk says in the Song of Songs and Shir HaShirim, Tzavarech kemigdal Hashem. Your neck is like a tower of ivory. That at that moment, Yaakov's neck became so powerful that Esav felt like he was biting into stone. And they both started crying. Yaakov because of his neck, and Esav because of his teeth. He tried to take a big bite out of something that became like a rock. They both cried. The other opinion says this was a moment in which Esav's compassion was aroused, and he kissed him with all the intent. He kissed him with a full heart. So this is a recurring theme that we have with Esav, that Esav has moments where he really cares. And then Esav has moments where he's ready to kill us. And he keeps fluctuating back and forth. That's our history with Esav. So Esav looks around and he asks, who are these? And Yaakov says, these are the kids that Hashem has given me in his kindness and mercy. And now everyone goes forward and bows. And we discussed last time how the sons of the maid refused to bow. And it's a weakness of theirs. When a person is weak, then they refuse to show honor to others because they're weak. When a person is strong, then they don't feel diminished by showing honor to others. And Esav offers Yaakov to come with him. The Medrash says, for the next 9 years, Yaakov sends bribes and gifts to Esav to keep him at bay. For 9 years, Yaakov will continue bribing him. But initially Esav says, I don't need anything. Yesh li rav, I have plenty. You keep yours. And Yaakov says, no, I found favor in your eyes. You take my gifts. And Esav offers to travel together. And Yaakov refuses. And we discussed over here the negative influences of people who join our crowd or join our family or join our table or join our lives. We have to think about the influences on our children. And so Yaakov gives a good excuse and Esav travels on. Okay, Esav goes his merry way. And Yaakov comes to a place called Sukkot. And he's going to spend 18 months there. A summer, a winter, a summer, 18 months. And then Yaakov comes to Shechem. He comes to Shechem. Vayichan et pnei ha'ir. The literal meaning is, he camped opposite the city. Vayichan comes from the word chanaya. He parked himself. He camped opposite the city. Our sages say Vayichan comes from the word chen. He added charm to the city. What did he do? So our sages say, he said, I made it back in peace. I have to show my appreciation. So one opinion says he opened a cheap butcher shop. He opened a butcher shop where you could buy meat cheaply. One opinion says he developed currency. Until he came, they were always bartering. And what Yaakov Avinu did was he developed the economy. He developed a currency, and so the economy could thrive. A third opinion says they weren't so clean. He came to Shechem and he saw the people there filthy and stinky. He said they don't have proper bathhouses here. People don't cleanse themselves. So he and his family built bathhouses for the people. A fourth opinion says that when he got there, he saw they didn't have good infrastructure. So he developed the roads around Shechem. That was what he developed. Whatever it is, he developed something long term. Fifth opinion says he set up an Erev for his family. Set up an Erev. Why is that so important? So Rav Herschel Schachter explains, when we set up an Erev, what we're saying is, this is where I camp, and this whole territory is where I will move on Shabbat. And when we set up an Erev, we are really defining the boundaries of our encampment for Shabbat. So Rav Herschel Schachter explained that when the Medrash says Yaakov Avinu established an Erev, what the Medrash is saying is that there was a paradigm shift. Until this point, Yaakov felt he has to continue the work of Avraham and Yitzchak to proselytize, to teach people about monotheism. And at this point, when Yaakov comes back to Israel and he has a family and he sees his family has become a clan and his family is going to be the Jewish people, so he says, I don't have to go educating. Now I have to start defining my boundaries. Who am I? Who is my family? And people who want can come and learn from us. But I don't have to work outwardly. I have to focus inwardly. So that's how he explains the fifth opinion in the Medrash as to what Yaakov Avinu did when he came to the city. Our sages say there was a great sage, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. There was a generation of Shmad that made a decree that no one should learn Torah. So he went with his son into the cave. He went into the cave to learn Torah. You all probably know the story that's quoted in Gemara Shabbos, that the Romans wanted Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai dead because of the way he spoke about the Roman Empire. But the Medrash doesn't quote it that way. The Medrash says it was a generation when they were making decrees prohibiting learning Torah. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son went into a cave to learn Torah. And there was a carob tree outside the cave that they lived from. And after 13 years, they came out of the cave. They had lived in the cave, so their bodies were hurt terribly from the dryness of the sand they had lived in, and they needed to heal themselves. So they went to the bathhouses up near Tveria, and they spent some time in the bathhouses there healing themselves. After they were healed, they said, "Let's show our appreciation to Tveria." Yaakov Avinu showed his appreciation to Shechem. He made it back in peace. We made it out of the cave in peace. We should show our appreciation to Tveria. So they said, what does Tveria need? Throughout the city of Tveria, there were corpses. And people couldn't know where they could walk and remain pure and where they could walk and become defiled. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son took a bean called a turmus, and they started scattering the beans, and based on how the beans would settle in the ground, they would say, over here there's a body, over here there isn't a body, over here yes, over here no. So one man heard that they were going around the marketplaces identifying the places where there were corpses, and he said, I don't believe in all this. So he waited until the night, and he went back to a marketplace that Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son had said the whole marketplace was clean. This market is completely pure. And he dragged the corpse and buried it in the marketplace. The next day, he says, Rabbi, I have a question. You said this marketplace is pure, right? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, yes, I said it's pure. So the man says, and I say there's a corpse there. So the Medrash says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai understood what had happened. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said, and I say there isn't. I say that the body that's there will get up and walk, and the body that's here, he said, pointing to the person, will stop standing and walking. And the next second, the person who did this dropped dead, and the corpse started moving the ground and came out of the ground and came back to life. So the Medrash says, now there was a corpse there, the guy who, the troublemaker, and there was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai invited the newly alive man to his house for dinner, and says he went there and ate by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So that's the Medrash, whatever it means, that's what the Medrash says. So the Medrash says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai learned from our Parsha. He says, the city of Tveria, their bathhouses are where we got cured. Let's show our appreciation to the city. Let's see what they need. And let's help them rectify the situations they have. There's a continuation to the story, but we have to continue in the parasha. If you're going to ask me questions about the Medrash, I don't have answers. Okay.
That's a good question.
Yeah, but I don't have answers. I don't know more than what I said. That's what it says.
Yeah, like you just said, they were implanted seeds so people wouldn't become defiled. But if they're going to plant the seeds, aren't they becoming defiled?
I don't know exactly how they used the turmus bean to identify what was beneath the ground. It could be that the way the bean connects to the ground indicates whether there's a body there or not. It could be that when a body decomposes in the soil, it emits certain minerals or chemicals or whatever that would cause the turmus bean either not to connect to the ground or not to grow or to connect in a different way. There was something they were doing with the turmus bean that would indicate, is there a body in the soil or not? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, but I'm saying by them going to the same place to plant the bean, I mean, there's a dead body there, so didn't they become defiled?
Could be. Yeah. So they were willing to defile themselves in order to verify what was pure and what not. Yeah.
But is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai leaves the cave and he sets the everything he looks at on fire. Is that part of the Sanhedrin?
The Medrash doesn't quote that part of the story. In the Gemara, you have that part of the story. In the Gemara, Maseches Shamas.
Was he essentially cursed? Was that? Mm-hmm. Was Hashem punishing him?
When we learn the Gemara, or what? That's not for now. Let's move on. That's a good question. If you want, later on tonight, when we have open session, we can come back to that. Rashbi. So Dina is home. And we discussed earlier in the week the idea that nailing closed the casket that Dina was in, according to some commentaries, was wrong. And so now Dina wants to go out. She's a modest girl. So she hears there's music playing outside. Why is there music? So the Midrash says that Shechem heard that there was a very good looking girl in Yaakov's family. But Dina was modest. He couldn't get a peek at her. So what did he do? He hired a band and he hired a bunch of girls to go and throw a party right near the camp of Yaakov Avinu. They wait till it's midday. Yaakov's sons, everyone's out with the cattle. And midday, he sends the band and the girls. And they start having an innocent little dance there. There's music playing, and there's dancing. So there's dancing. Dina is an active person. Dina will, later on in her life, marry a man named Eov. We know him as Job. And she will cause him to do tshuva. She will bring him to the highest of heights. So Dina is a person who connects to people and elevates them to the point where our sages say that had she married Esav, all of world history would have been different. She would have changed Esav. She was so capable, she could have made Esav become a tzaddik. What no one else could do. His father, his mother, Yaakov Avinu, no one else did it. But Dina could have done it. So Dina hears the girls dancing. She figures, this is innocent. Maybe she thought my grandmother, Sarah, also connected to women and in such brought them to monotheism. So she goes out to meet the girls of the land. And Shechem has been in the bushes hiding and waiting for this moment. And when he sees her, he decides that she's very good looking. He wants her. He rides up on his horse, whisks her up, and kidnaps her into his palace. So after he kidnaps her, he violates her in every way imaginable and decides that he loves her. So he starts talking to her about all the wonderful things they can do together. He says, look at your father, how much money he had to spend for a little piece of land. I'll marry you and then your whole family will own this whole city. And he starts telling her all kinds of things to convince her that she should stay with him. And here the Medrash tells us a frightening thought. Technically, you would think that Dina would hate him. Look at what he did to her. And the Medrash says that Dina fell in love with him. The Medrash says that Dina didn't want to leave. The Medrash says, Kashai ha'ola liparesh mimena. That when a non-Jew decides he's attached to a Jewish girl, so he can bring her to a point where she won't want to leave him. Our sages say there is this weakness within the soul of a Jewish woman that she can very easily connect to a non-Jewish man and desire to stay with him. And even such a pious girl like Dina, says the Medrash, she didn't want to leave. He was able to conquer her heart. So this is an eye-opener to us. If our daughters want to go to university, if our daughters want to work at the local supermarket and the guy who's bagging behind the counter is a non-Jew and they're going to spend their days together, then you can't assume I gave her a good education and there's no way she's going to go down that road. Could be you gave her a great education. Yaakov Avinu gave Dina a great education too. And still you see that he was able to take over her heart after he had hurt her and violated her. And even so, the Medrash says he was able to win her over. Vaydaber alev hanara. He found the way to talk to win over her heart. So Shechem tells his father, the king Hamor, he says, I want you to arrange a wedding between me and this girl. And here we have to notice the stark difference between what happened until this moment in Genesis and Bereishis and what happens here. Until this moment, every Jewish woman that was abducted made it out unscathed. Sarai Menu was taken twice, yet the kings were punished and they couldn't do a thing to her. Right? Rivka Emenu was almost taken, but nothing happened. And Yaakov has to experience something very different than Avraham and Yitzchak experienced. It's his innocent daughter that's taken and violated and not returned. And not returned. The conversation is now going to take place in a very vile manner. Shechem and Hamor are going to come and talk to him when the girl is in their palace. Let's have a conversation. Are you ready to marry off your daughter to our son? Right, after they kidnapped her and they don't bring her back, the conversation is taking place when she is in Hamor's palace. So there's something very wrong, not only about what was done initially, but about the continued conversation. Because what's happening here is they took the girl, and now Hamor is backing his son, and their actions represent a confidence that they have that the people are backing them. Because if they didn't think the people backed them, then they wouldn't get away with this. They wouldn't have done this. But now they feel that their behavior expresses a certain style of society. This is okay what we did. And no one's going to take us to task over this. When our sages say that the reaction of Yaakov's sons was a reaction that there was no legal system, so I think what our sages are teaching us is there was a modus operandi of the area of Shechem. That Hamor and Shechem could think that they can get away with this. And Yaakov Avinu was obviously without any legal power to protest what they had done. So our sages say, now pay attention. The sons of Yaakov are going to kill the whole city because they say, you didn't give us a choice. You didn't give us a system to work with. One of the seven Noahide laws is there has to be a legal system. If they can get away with kidnapping, violating, and then coming and asking us for a deal, then obviously you guys don't have a legal system here. So Yaakov is aware of what happened. They won't discuss whether Shechem violated Dina or not. But Yaakov's well aware of where things are holding. I don't know how Yaakov dealt with this. Because to Yaakov, this is very different than what happened to his father and grandfather, right? He must have known the stories of what happened to Yitzchak and Avram. This is a very different test. Rabbon Shom, for Avram Avinu, you sent an angel. He beat up Paro. He caused everyone in Paro's house to become ill. Why doesn't Dina get that treatment? No, that's not what's going to happen. And I'll tell you another difficult angle to the story. When Dina will be returned, she will be pregnant. And there's going to be a big discussion in the family. What do we do with that fetus? What do we do with this baby? It's Shechem's baby. Are we leaving him in the family? And we're going to get there in a few minutes. So Yaakov hears how his daughter was violated, but his sons aren't around. And so Yaakov refuses to answer Shechem and Hamor. And here again, we learn a lot from Yaakov's behavior. Sometimes people ask us questions, and sometimes people pressure us to give answers. It is legitimate to say nothing. It is legitimate to say, I'm not answering now. Very often we feel like we must give an answer. The boss is pressuring us, our neighbors, someone else who seems to have a higher position of authority. We are very powerful when we push things off. Last week, someone came to me with a tremendous amount of pressure and insisted that I agree to something, which it seemed he was right on. And I said, I don't know. So the guy started yelling at me. And I said, I don't know.
True story.
Last week. And then the guy said to me, you know, there are a lot of important people who signed on this letter, and you're not signing. I said, right. And he said, you should just realize that you're not signing is also a statement. I said, it's a statement that says, I don't know. I don't know if I should or shouldn't sign, and I'm not going to sign it right now. If you guys want to take that as a statement that that I'm not signing, you can do that. If you want to wait and I'm going to think about it, you can do that too. But I'm not signing. And the person, after yelling at me for a very long time, had to leave. Now, on the moment, you feel like, hey, all these other people signed, and they're people who you respect. Shouldn't I also sign? There were good reasons to wonder whether I should or shouldn't sign. But the key is what Yaakov Avinu does. He's silent and waits. And that's a right we all have. And so Yaakov Avinu in this situation is silent. And he's waiting for his sons. Chazal tell us, you want to measure the greatness of a kingdom? Look at how many consultants they have. King David's kingdom is considered a great kingdom because he consulted. Because he wasn't quick to act. Because he didn't act before talking to people. So in life, we don't always have to make decisions on the spot. As a matter of fact, almost always, we're better off if we wait. Now, there's one area where people really make huge mistakes in their life. It's email and WhatsApp. People have a thought, they hit the button, and then it's gone. It's not the way intelligent people work. Intelligent people make sure to think things through. You're not sure whether or not to send the email? Sleep on it. And another good tip, don't put the sender, don't put the to, don't put an address. So you don't by mistake hit the send button. Right? You wrote something, you want to think about it. You know, Abraham Lincoln, when he died, they found a drawer filled with letters that he never sent. He would write the letter expressing all his frustration and anger at someone, and then he'd leave the letter in his drawer. Better not send it. I can tell you, I hope none of you ever break into my email, but in my drafts, there are a lot of drafts that never got sent. There are a lot of letters that I drafted and decided, nope. The key is wait. Yaakov's waiting. He's silent. And we can imagine the pressure Yaakov felt thinking about every moment that his daughter is in the palace of Shechem. But specifically when there's pressure, you want to make the right decision. Yaakov's sons come back from the field. And they're very upset. And until this point, such a thing was not done. Not done in general. And here, this was a break from the norm of society, and especially in their family. So Shechem is silent. He's in the room. And Hamor tells them, you know, my son desires your daughter. Let him marry her. You'll marry us. You'll choose which girls we should marry. And you'll take any of the girls that we have that you like. Notice the politician. He tells them, you'll choose which girls you want to give us. And then you'll take whatever girls you want from ours. When he'll talk to the people of Shechem, he's going to say the exact opposite. Their girls are ripe for the picking. We'll take whichever girls we want. And we'll only give them whatever girls we want to give. And his actions contradict his words. Because his words, you'll choose whichever girls you want, but you'll give us whichever girls you want, which says you'll retain control. They just violated that just now. Right? The idea that you'll have full control. Dina's already there, right? So he says, you'll be able to develop the marketplaces here. You'll take control of the land. And Yaakov and his sons aren't moving. So Shechem says to the father and brothers, he says...
Why is Dina so valuable to them like this? Like they're offering marketplaces, they're even offering...
Talk is cheap. They're not offering anything. They're offering talk.
Oh, so they're selling dreams?
They believe that if they paint a beautiful picture of what would happen if they unite with Yaakov and his family, Yaakov and his family will buy into it.
They weren't planning on keeping him this before they say...
Chazal seem to point out the contradictions in their offers, and so Chazal seem to indicate that it was all in order to get them to buy in. If I didn't have Chazal, I would have said, I haven't found the source for this yet, but I would have said that it was in their best interest to marry into Yaakov's family. Everyone knew that ultimately they would inherit the land of Israel. So just like Avimelech wanted a peace treaty with them, this would be one up from Avimelech. They married into the family. But that's my interpretation. I haven't found the basis for that in Chazal. I'm saying if I were writing the story, I would imagine that was their drive. And Chazal said no. Chazal keep pushing the contradictions between what they're going to say here and what they're going to say later. It seems from Chazal more that this was all politics. This was about let us get what we want and just make promises. So he says, I want to find favor in your eyes. Tell me what you want. You ask for a lot of money, I'll give it to you. You ask for a lot of gifts, I'll give it to you. Just let me marry the girl. So Yaakov's sons answer him. It doesn't say here who answered him. In the end of Bereishis, so Yaakov's going to turn to Shimon and Levi and say, you two are brothers. What loyal brothers you are for Dinah. But at this point, the Torah doesn't identify who are the sons that speak up. Our tradition is that it was Shimon and Levi. So let's figure out, how old were Shimon and Levi? So they had to be about 13 and 14 years old, because Yaakov had worked 7 years in order to marry Leah, and then he had another 7 years working for Rachel. He had Reuven right away, and then Shimon, and then Levi. So let's say he had Levi in his eighth year there, and then Shimon in his eighth year, and Levi in his ninth year. And then he was going to be there another 6 and 5 years respectively, until he works another 6 years just for money, right? He has 7, 7, and 6. 7 years for Leah, 7 years for Rachel, and 6 years to make money. How do I know that? Because it says it in the Pasuk. Avadticha, Yaakov tells Lavan, I worked for you. 14 years for your two daughters. V'sheish shanim betzonecha, and 6 years developing your sheep. So we know he was there a total of 13 years after he married Leah and Rachel. So that puts Shimon at 12 and Levi at 11 when they left. We said they spent another year and a half. You remember we said summer, winter, summer. So now he's going to be 13 and a half. He's going to be 12 and a half. And this is all an approximation. So you could say either 12 and a half, 13 and a half, or 14 and 13.
So how old is Dina?
How old is Dina? That's a good question. So let's do the math. Dina was born at the end. She was born before Yosef. So she was born at the end of the second 7 years. So Dina's going to be 7 to 8 years old. 7 and a half years old.
So he violates her 7 years.
Correct. She was 7 and a half years old, Dina. Right. It's a good point. Very good point. Good. We just did the math, right? She was born at the end. She was born before Yosef. Yosef was born at the end of the 7 years. So let's say she was born in 6 years. So that makes her 7 when they left. She was around 8 at this point. Yes. Let's see. We'll get there. It's a good question. Let me tell you something. I have a son who's 13. And he's bigger than me. I'm not such a big guy. But you see in Africa today, a lot of their warriors are young. 11-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-olds. They don't have fear. Oh, no. They don't have fear. So they tell him, you know, in our family, when you want to curse someone out, you tell him, you uncircumcised one. That's for us a way of putting someone down. We really look down at people who have a foreskin. It's a shame for us. So if you want to be like us, if you want to circumcise yourself, then we'll agree. And we'll let you have our daughters, and we'll take your daughters, and we'll stay here, and we'll become one nation. And if you don't listen, so we're going to take our daughter and leave. So
Couldn't they have said her sister?
They all treated her as their daughter. So Hamor liked the idea, Shechem liked the idea. If we want to look more deeply, our sages say that the circumcision is what gives us a right to the land of Israel. It's after Hashem commanded us to circumcise that Avram was told he's going to have the land of Israel. So our sages taught us that the circumcision, the Brit Milah, is part and parcel with the covenant and the connection to the land of Israel. So on that level, if we want to look at it that way, it could be that's why they liked it. If we're going with what I was suggesting, which again, I haven't found good sources for yet. So,
before they said, they're going to take
right.
Our daughters.
Right.
So they're going to get to it.
So that's part of the brilliance of what they're saying. If they would have just been nice, then it wouldn't have been believable. By being a little bit tough and making a condition that sounded very tough, so it was very believable to Shechem and Hamor. This made sense to them. I always thought, my humble opinion, that they wanted to accomplish another thing. After Shechem circumcises, he has to stop violating Dina. He's not capable of functioning for a week or two. So they just bought time. Even if everything else doesn't work, they've just bought time. That was my opinion. I'm saying again, this is my own thought. I'm saying practically, yeah. That they were accomplishing one thing in doing this. Step one, they put an end to one problem they had to deal with. But again, that's Netanel Frankel's shot. I don't remember ever seeing it inside. So there's a pasuk here which I always liked. The pasuk says, "V'lo echar hanar la'asot ha'davar." The lad didn't postpone to do it. And I always felt like this pasuk is telling us something about youth and their frivolity. That he's about to destroy his whole people, right? He's about to lose everything. And I always thought that that's why the pasuk points it out. He didn't stop to think. He didn't delay. He right away went and did it. So that's an insight, right? Because he rushed to do it. Yaakov Avinu's under pressure, and he's not in a rush. He waits. He waits till the sons come, and they figure out the right answer. The lad, here's the deal, he rushes out to do it. So I think that's why the pasuk, maybe that's why the pasuk points this out. So he was the most honored son of Hamor. So he comes with his father to the gate, as the people always have to go through the gates. That's the place of gathering. And they tell the men of the city, these people, oh boy, are they whole with us. They're going to settle here. They're going to develop business here. And look at what a great broad area we have over here. There's so much room. We're just going to take their girls. Believe me, they have beautiful girls. We'll take their girls. They're there for the picking. And then we'll give them whatever girls we want to give. Notice how he switches everything. And they just have this little condition that every one of us circumcises the same way they circumcise. And believe me, they got a lot of cattle. And it's all ours once we become one. So we're going to be able to get all their wealth. We just have to agree to this one condition, and they're going to stay and become one with us. So the people listen, and they circumcise all their males. And on the third day, it takes quite a while to circumcise all the men of the city. The people are writhing in pain. And Yaakov's two sons, Shimon and Levi, the brothers of Dinah, they take their swords and they enter the city, and there's no man who could stand up to them. Some of the commentaries say that there were plenty of men who refused to circumcise, but they didn't dare stick around. They ran away. They didn't want to be caught breaking the king's law. So the only men who were in the city were men who couldn't move out of bed. So now they went. Now I once heard a pshat, which I don't remember if I saw inside. I heard from Rav Giat, who's a Moel. So he said to me that he thinks that what Shimon and Levi did was they go to the houses and say, we are expert Mohalim. We do circumcisions in our family. We will check up on the patients. And they came to each house and they knocked on the door and they said, we want to check up on the patient. So they'd come in and the patient would be lying in bed, writhing in pain. And they'd say, let's check up on you. And so during the checkup, they made sure to alleviate him from his pain. So he said he thinks that's what happened here. How did the two overcome a whole city? They went house by house, and before anyone could know what was going on, they had wiped out the city. And he said they'd probably come in, check up on the guy, execute him, cover him up real well, and tell the family, go out and tell the family, look, we gave him some drugs, he's out, he's sleeping now. Don't disturb him for the next 2-3 hours, because he's right now having the first peaceful night in a long time. And the family would go, right, you're so right, yes. He wasn't sleeping the last 2 nights. And they said, don't worry, now you hear he's not groaning, now he's comfortable, everything's great, don't bother him, okay? Leave him to sleep. And then they'd close the door and leave the house. And by the time anyone realized what had happened, they had already finished off the city, all the men of the city. So that's how Rav Giat said he thinks that's... And I don't remember if he quoted this to me from a source or this was his pshat. So they come to the castle. They're going to give royal treatment to Shechem and Hamor. And they execute Shechem and Hamor, and they take Dinah out of the house. The rest of the family hears that the city's theirs. They come in and loot the city. And they take over all the wealth of the city. And they bring it all back to Yaakov's compound. So they take all the children and women and all the wealth of the city. They bring it back to Yaakov. So the Medrash says that when they came to the castle, so Dinah stood in their way and said, don't touch Shechem. And they shoved her out of the way and they killed Shechem. And she sat there weeping and said, who's going to marry me? What are you doing to me? What life do I have left to lead? It's very nice that you're killing Shechem, but where am I going with all this? And according to one Medrash, Shimon promised her that he would take her as part of his family. And she joined Shimon's family. And the early commentaries write that right next to Shimon's grave, there's a grave of Dinah. There are two burial plots in Israel, which in ancient times they said this was Shimon's grave, and right next to him was Dinah, that Shimon promised her that she would become a part of his family. And she was. She was in his family till the day she died. That's one Medrash. And the other Medrash says that she ultimately married Eov. There's a third Medrash that says she became an old spinster. She just lived the life alone the rest of her life. But either way, Dinah is brought back home, and Yaakov tells Shimon and Levi, you've destroyed me. Now I can't think straight, because we have neighbors here, and there were peace treaties. And the neighboring cities all around are going to feel threatened. They're going to say, Yaakov came back with a clan. He's trying to take over the land. And I don't have enough people to stand up to war against all of them. And you know what? If they all come to war, I'm finished. So, Shimon and Levi answer him. They say, you expect us to just sit idly by as our sister is taken for free? Like a woman of ill repute. And Yaakov doesn't answer them. And to my mind, this was always an amazing lesson, the conversation between Yaakov and his children. If you read the Torah until this point, it sounds like they won the argument. Yaakov doesn't answer them. But wait a second, did they win the argument? Meaning Yaakov said, we're all as good as dead. What did you accomplish? And they said, are you going to let our sister be like that? But what kind of answer is that? What did they accomplish if they're all going to die? And the conversation ends here, it would seem. But really it doesn't. Really, the conversation continues on Yaakov's deathbed. Yaakov won't answer them here. But when Yaakov is in his final hour, he's going to call them in. And now he's going to answer them. And he's going to tell them, "Klei chamas mechirotehim. You used tools that are not from our family. B'sodam al tarvo nafshi. I had nothing to do with your secret to go and murder a whole city. B'kalam al techad kivodi. My honor wasn't with you when you guys gathered. And ki ve'apam harigu ish. It was your anger that allowed you to kill people. U'virtzonam ikirushur. And it was your desire that allowed you to destroy a whole city." Yaakov does not answer them now. It's not because Yaakov agrees. But Yaakov will answer them at the very end when he's lying on his deathbed. He'll say, now let's go back to that conversation. And there's a lesson here. Chazal say that we don't rebuke people early in life, because sometimes rebuke will cause them to leave the family. We always take rebuke personally. There's a rule. The person who gives rebuke thinks it's not personal. I just told you you made a mistake. It's not about you. There's a mistake. You have to change it. The person who receives the rebuke always takes it personally. And so Yaakov is very wary. When Yaakov tells them about the danger, he has to tell them about the danger, because war is about to break out. He's right. He's 100% right. What's about to happen will endanger his whole family. But he's not into the argument. He's not into the fight. What's done is done. Now he has to stand up and protect them. So Yaakov also teaches us that you don't always have to win an argument. You don't always have to answer. Sometimes children give you an answer that says, I'm not listening. Yaakov Avinu knew everything they said. It was his daughter. They weren't telling him anything he didn't know. And their argument doesn't really counter his argument. Yaakov doesn't answer them now. There are multiple themes here. Number one, we don't always have to win an argument. Number two, if we've made our point and a child answers us, we don't always have to disprove the child. I made my point. A child's answer, if it wasn't a serious answer to me, I don't always have to answer. I made my point. He had the need to answer me. He made his point. We move on. You don't always have to say, you know, your answer doesn't answer my question. Yaakov Avinu said, you're endangering all of us. They say, that's not a good argument, what they said. And finally, we see the point that rebuke has to be really thought out. And so Yaakov's going to wait a long time before he takes them to task over this. His rebuke will accomplish a tremendous change in Levi. It will not accomplish in Shimon. One of the two will succeed in doing tshuva, Levi. So his rebuke is important. But these are a few lessons we learned from this conversation. Yes?
Is it also the danger that you don't rebuke now, that the child will do it again?
But he did what he had to. He told them what they did was wrong. Meaning, that's why I said he got his point across. He said, you guys endangered everyone right now. He's not saying we have to sit idly by as this happens. He is saying you just endangered the whole family. So we will continue.